1966, John Lennon did an interview with the Evening Standard of London, in which he was asked several questions, and in response to one of the questions, he had made a pretty remarkable statement that he had said that the Beatles were more famous than Jesus Christ. Now, some of you may remember that comment. I wasn't born at that time, so I'm picking up from the stories. Maybe there's some of you who don't even know who John Lennon is. We'll find out in a few minutes if you do or don't. But I think what John Lennon, who was the key singer to the Beatles, the point that he was making was simply this, that as the entertainment culture was rising in North America with the popularity of rock and roll, there was a beginning wane of the Christian faith, and it was evident. And so what John Lennon was proclaiming was simply the triumph and the rise and the triumph of the entertainment industrial complex. Music and art, it's become a business form, and it's been encapsulated in video, and in our day it's become even more prolific that you can pull out a smartphone out of your pocket, you can go to YouTube or TikTok, and you can watch videos to no end, and you can find incredible information, so that now education and entertainment have been so blurred that it's really hard to tell the difference. Neil Postman, the media theorist who died in 2003, he wrote a book. It's a very well-known book, and it's a very significant book that if you haven't read it, I would encourage you to read. It's called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And in that book, what Neil Postman does is he looks at the entertainment industry, and he sees how that the value of entertainment is incredibly dangerous because it causes amusement. And the word to amuse simply means when you have the letter A in front of something, it means to not, that's to negate, not be thinking, musing. And what entertainment does is it causes you to stop thinking. And what Neil Postman argued in his book was simply that if we became a culture of entertainment, we would no longer be able to engage critically in our thought process and in our engagement process to discern the world around us. And now we live in an age where we flip through videos faster than a goldfish has memory. That we can discern something whether we want to watch it or not in less than 3 seconds. In fact, I was just flipping through the radio yesterday as I was driving, and I noticed I do this myself, that it's a matter of half a second. That if I'm not amused, that I'm quickly scanning to the next channel. And now we live in an age where you don't even have to scan in the radio. You simply go to your device and you hook it up to your car stereo, and you can listen to what you want to choose. And so we've become this era, we live in this era where we amuse ourselves, and yet we call this not only entertainment but education. So it's no surprise then that the very thing that I think parents have said this throughout most generations. They've said things like, do your homework first, then you can play. Yeah, someone said, right. Yeah, I heard that. I think I've maybe said that sometimes to my kids. It was said to me, and I think it was said to my parents as well. Now, play has changed, and certainly it looks different, but the principle has been work first, then do the have your time of enjoyment. And when we come to Proverbs 9, what we find is that the parents here are about to launch their son into the world. Just a quick word on Proverbs 1 through 9. We're going to end this morning in Proverbs 9, which has been a series of speeches from the father to the son, from Solomon to his son. And suddenly in chapter 10, the book is going to change. We'll talk about that change next week because it's substantially different from Proverbs 10 through 29. And we need to get a sense that is there chaos or is there coherence? We'll talk about that next week. But notice this, that this is the last speech that the father gives to his son as the son now is launched into the world and the parents are going to disappear from the scene from chapters 10 through 29. They're going to totally fade away. And so the parents are launching their child out into the world. And in order to launch them out with success, what they want to do is they want their child to discern and decide the future. And to discern and to decide means that they have to know the various paths that are out there. And there are two paths. There's the path of wisdom and there's the path of folly. And in this closing speech of this opening section to the book, what we have are is the voice of the parents saying to the child, here are the two options. You've got to discern and you've got to decide. And we're going to help you to know how you discern and decide the path that you should go on. Because all of us need to discern and to decide this way. There is a choice. But when John Lennon spoke about his band, the Beatles, being more famous than Jesus Christ, what many people did, what many Christians did, especially in the Southern Bible Belt of the United States, is they took the albums and they burned them and they boycotted the Beatles. And what became as a reaction against the Beatles, there was a counter-reaction that also happened. But if you notice what the parents of Proverbs 1 through 9 have been doing, is that they are not launching some missive against Dame Folly, but what they are doing is trying to persuade their son that there is a better way to live, to point out the good way, the good life, the good path. And Proverbs is all about wisdom, but it's about wisdom for the sake of living a good life. And a life not only now, but a life forever. And so the parents, what they do is that they try to set the trajectory of their child on a path for life. And they're trying to point out, here is the path for life. In verses 1 through 6 and verses 13 through 18, we get these two pictures. And they function as bookends in this chapter, so that there's the way of the Lady Wisdom in verses 1 through 6 and Dame Folly in verses 13 through 18. And we'll come back to the middle verses in a moment. But what they do is they compare and they contrast these two women and these two ways, because the women are not merely women. They are also ways of worship. They are ways of life. They are ways of living and of adoring and of functioning. And what the parents are seeking to do then is to say, here's your choice. Son, you're going out into the world. Proverbs 10 is coming. You're going to be on your own. And we want to set you up for success. And so, you need to discern and decide. And I want you to see a couple things, why discernment is absolutely important. When we come to these two voices of wisdom and folly, I want you to notice in verses 4 and verse 16 that their voices sound exactly the same. Look at what Woman Wisdom says in verse 4, whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And then look at verse 16. Dame Folly, she says, whoever is simple, let him turn in here. The very voice of wisdom and folly initially sounds exactly the same. Not only that, but both women, we notice that their situation where wisdom lives is that she is in, we're told in verse 3, the second part of verse 3, she's in the high places of the town. But that's also where Dame Folly is. She is loud and she speaks. Verse 14 tells us she takes a seat on the highest places of town. So here we have wisdom and folly. They say almost the same thing initially. And they're in the same place. So how do you know which one's wisdom and how do you know which one's folly? You see, wisdom and folly, they can initially look identical. And that ought to give us some pause, that just because we think that we know the way that is right, it may actually be the way that leads to death, which is what Proverbs 14 and 16 will say. There's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death, because initially the voice of folly can look exactly the same as the way of wisdom. That you can think that you're following the way of the wise, but initially there's not much difference. Until you start to learn what it means to discern. And when you start to discern, what you discover is that while the initial offering and the initial place of the offering may be the same, what follows is fundamentally different. Look at a couple things. First, let's consider the offer of these two women. First, let's look at the meal that is offered. What does the wise woman of Proverbs 9, verses 1 through 6 offer? We're told in verse 2, she slaughtered her beasts, she has mixed her wine, she set her table. We're told that in verse 5, she says, come eat of my bread and drink of the wine that I have mixed. Here, what woman wisdom has is this incredible spread of a feast. And what she offers is a well-prepared meal. It's taken time, it's taken effort, it's taken diligence, it's costly. And we fail to appreciate that because we can go to Costco and we can get our nice cut of beef and it's not too expensive, right? But in the, well, yeah, beef is maybe a little bit more. Yeah, thanks, Seb. Yeah, beef is more. Maybe it's your chicken or your poultry or your pork or whatever it is. But in the ancient world, to slaughter an animal was incredibly costly. It was incredibly expensive to eat meat. And so to be eating meat at a feast was luxurious. And so here, woman wisdom is offering something incredibly luxurious. And notice what she's offering? Not only meat, but wine that's mixed. It's got a mixture to it that the implication here is that what's mixed in is not just something to dilute it, but something that adds to it. And she offers bread, and she offers this incredible spread. It's taken time, it's been costly, it's taken great effort, and as a result of that, she puts out this great spread, and it's a feast. But Dame Folly, this foolish woman, what does she offer? We see that when she offers in verse 17 is something that is incredibly different. Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. What she offers is not hard work, but she offers easy, simple access to cheap, fast food and junk. It's water and bread. The other woman is offering wine and a great meat, a great cut of meat and fresh bread. She's offering the full spread, woman wisdom is, whereas Dame Folly is offering, notice what it says, stolen food. It's not something that she's worked hard for. She's taken it. She's probably found the remnants and borrowed the benefits of what woman wisdom has had, and she's taken it. And this is what is happening in our world today, that we are living in the coattails here in the 21st century. We are living on the coattails of the wisdom of Christianity that established nations and governance and rules and equity of law and of justice. We're riding the coattails of that. It's been stolen, on a sense. And we're living in this day where we have all the benefits of Christianity, but we want to eschew Christianity. We want to reject Christianity from the public square. And we want to say it's not a welcome voice. And what that will prove to do is we'll see that what the offer is, it initially looks like a great offer, but the danger that lies ahead is incredibly profound. This whole idea of what Dame Folly offers, verse 17, stolen water is sweet, bread eaten in secret, it has this sense that the naughty is actually more pleasurable than the nice. And there's something that we know. We know this to be true. That there's something about the forbidden that it feels exciting. It feels exhilarating. It's why when an affair happens, when adultery happens, it's the excitement that initially is the euphoria of the moment. It's stolen. It tastes sweet. This is the danger of pornography. Pornography is stolen, and it offers a sweetness, but it only lasts for a moment. It's not a lasting, sure, secure, committed, covenantal relationship. What it is something stolen, something that doesn't belong to you, something that takes from another. And in taking from another, it offers you easy access, instantaneous, instant gratification, but it doesn't last. It's the food of the two women. Dame Folly, whose fast food might give you 1,000 calories in a couple of bites. But woman wisdom will feed you a feast that will satisfy your soul over and over again. And so the offering here they are incredibly different offers. But notice also that it's not just in comparing the offerings, it's in comparing the invitations. The invitation to the places where these women are, notice verse 1, where woman wisdom is. She has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. Here is this glorious, in a sense, beautiful, hewn, hardworking woman, this woman who is hardworking and has hewn out a place of adoration which functions. Tremper Longman, in his commentary on Proverbs, he says these function like temples. They're in the high places, we're told, in verse 3. And so there's this element of worship. And in finding this place of worship, it is a place that has been tested and tried with hard work. It's been over years and years. And you contrast that, this hardworking woman who offers wisdom to you, who has hewn out seven pillars. We have no idea what these seven pillars mean. People speculate. I think it's unhelpful. I think the simple point is, this is a glorious building. This is a glorious house that she lives in. She's worked hard to build this place of adoration and worship in this high place, but it's contrasted with Dame Folly. And Dame Folly, we're told in verse 13, she is not hardworking. She is loud and boisterous and seductive, verse 13 says, and she knows nothing. She's not hardworking, we're told in verse 14. She sits at the door of her house and she takes the seat in the high place. And this is the alternative. We've seen this alternative being played out through Proverbs 1 through 9, the different types of worship, that there is the worship of God and the worship of His name and the worship of His character and His glory. And it is set in a high place. But there were these other gods that Solomon followed. We see this in chapter 2, verse 16. These other foreign wives that Solomon married who led him astray, that tempted him to worship other gods so that he would set up these places, these high places, these temples, these sacrifices to these foreign gods. And instead of the hard work of worship, there is this temptation to the easy access of idolatry. And we've gone through previously in the children's ministry moments what idolatry is. It's when we set our affections upon anything else other than God. And here what Dame Folly does is she seduces. But do you notice how Dame Folly seduces? This is something that I was thinking about. Dame Folly does not seduce by her beauty. She seduces by her words. She uses her words, and we see this as she cries out to those who pass by, we're told in verse 15, who are going straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to the one who lacks sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. And here is her offering. What she offers is a seduction by her words. And how many times, I was thinking about this even this week, person who is eloquent, who is persuasive, who is winsome, who can often speak in an effective manner, they can draw you right in. They can have all the branding, they can have all the logos, they can look pretty, they can make things look great. And when you pull back the veneer of all of this outward performance, so often what you find is that it's a mile wide and an inch deep. And what you discover is that there is a seduction that often happens in our culture, even by words. It happens by appealing to you with sound bites and quick comments, things that you can grasp hold of in 3 seconds or less. And so the political machinery knows this. It's not about the substance of policy, it's about the quality of the soundbite. That what will grab your attention and what will align you to a political movement is not the overall philosophy, but the soundbite that sounds best in the cultural moment. And when you pull that away, when you pull back the veneer of the soundbite, what do you discover? It's a mile wide, but it's an inch deep. There's nothing of substance there, in other words. And that we ought to be careful that just because someone can speak with eloquence, Paul will say this over and over to the churches in the New Testament. He'll talk about the super apostles to the Corinthians, and he'll say, I want you to beware of these folks. Man, they can speak a great word, but can they live the life? And what Dame Folly offers is a seduction by words. And Paul will say this in 2 Timothy, that there will come a day where people will not endure sound doctrine, but they will have their itching ears satisfied by someone who will come along and scratch them. And so it's easier to listen to a 20-minute TED Talk than a 30-minute expositional sermon. That's just the reality. Because what folly offers is easy, instantaneous access to what makes you happy now. But what wisdom offers is something that is not a mile wide and an inch deep, but something that is a mile deep. And that if you will mine into wisdom, what you will find is that there is something profound there. Both women are calling out to the simple. Come here, turn in here. There is an offering that they are giving, but the result, let's consider the result. That's the last thing I want to consider. Look at what the result is of woman wisdom. She says in verse 6, leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of insight. And here is what wisdom offers. It offers the path to life and life abundant. And she offers it over and over and over. But what does Dame Folly offer? Verse 18. He does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. In Woman Wisdom's house, there is life and life abundant, and in Dame Folly's house, there's dead bodies. There's just this littering of people who have come and they have taken of Dame Folly's ways, they have absorbed the culture of death, and they themselves have died. That the result has been death. There's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. And so while these things, they might look similar, while there might be a lot of similarities, what you discover is that when you get past the initial surface of what exists, there's something profoundly different. And that's where discernment comes in. Before you make a decision about the path, you need to know that not all the options are equal options. Not all paths that are offered to life actually lead to life. Not all the ways that claim to be wise are actually wise. Not all that looks cool is actually life-giving. And this is why we not only have to discern and decide, but in this middle section, what we are taught in verses 7 through 12 is that we have to learn the way of the wise. Now, there's all sorts of discussion. Why is this interlude here in the middle of this this section on Dame Folly on the one side and Dame Wisdom on the other side, Woman Wisdom on the other side? Why do these six verses exist here? And I think simply what they do is they function to point out how critically important it is that we learn the way of the wise. First, before we jump into these verses, notice who is called by both Dame Folly and Woman Wisdom. She is calling out to the simple. In other words, it's the person who needs to grow in discerning that the call of wisdom and folly is going out to. But in these verses, we don't get the contrast between the simple and the wise. Who is the person that is contrasted? Do you see it there in verse 7? It's a scoffer. And the scoffer actually has no hope. There is no hope offered in verses 7 through 12, or actually in the first part of this book, for a scoffer. Someone who is mocking, who is scoffing, who ridicules. What Proverbs says is they're on a hopeless trajectory. And this is what you need to discern. You want to know the way of the wise? Then you've got to discern what is wise and what is folly. And the way that you can discern that is not just by what is offered, but by what is also the kind of person who is giving it to you. It's the kind of character that's being offered. And so there is the scoffer and there is the wise. Now, the scoffer, what we are told in verses 7 through 9, is the scoffer is the kind of person that when you, well, the fundamental principle here is you can discern the difference between a wise person and a scoffer by how they handle correction. Here's what the scoffer does. Verse 7, whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse, and he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. So here's what happens. When you correct someone who thinks that they know it all, they've got it figured out, they know the path of life, they don't need your advice, they don't receive advice, they don't receive correction, what happens is, this is the kind of person who we're told is abusive, who will injure you, and who will hate you. That's exactly what verses 7 and 8 say. That what happens when you correct a scoffer is that they hate your advice. They don't want to listen to your advice. Proverbs will go on and say this, listen to advice and accept instruction, and in the end, you will be wise. But a fool, a scoffer, hates advice. They hate correction. And in fact, what they will do is they will seek to undermine you. They will abuse you. They will injure you. They don't listen to others. They want to pick up their football and go home and take it and not play. They want it their way, and if they don't get their way, then they're done. Because they hate you. And this is the fundamental difference, then, between a scoffer and a wise person. A wise person, we're told at the end of verse 8, if you correct a wise man, what will he do? He'll love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be wiser still. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase in learning. And this is the fundamental difference that exists. Is the one who receives correction, the one who can take it in, the one who can absorb it, the one who doesn't always have to be right or have to get their way. It's the lifelong learner. It's the humble. And Proverbs 9, verse 10, makes it clear who this wise person is. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. The last word of verse 6 in the English Standard Version, leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of insight, is also the last word of verse 10. Because what the way of wisdom is, the way of wisdom is the way, what the Old Testament calls the fear of the Lord is simply this. It's repentance and faith. It's being a lifelong learner. It's being humble. It's being teachable. It's being open to correction. And it's not just being open to correction, it's inviting correction. It's pursuing correction. It's welcoming it as though I have blind spots, and because I have blind spots, I need you to help me. Have you ever gone out to eat at a meal and you've got something stuck on your tooth? If you're smiling and talking away to someone and telling all sorts of stories, and they're looking at you kind of funny, this is why we need correction. This is why we need to invite and pursue correction, is because we have these blind spots, and we've got junk on our teeth, and we're smiling, and we think that we've got it all together. Meanwhile, everybody else is looking at us and going, how do I just mention that they've got a piece of lettuce stuck on their front tooth? I don't want to embarrass them, right? We've all had these moments. We've all had these moments, but that's what it is. It's that we've got these blind spots, and the wise person receives the correction. They take it in. They welcome it. They're thankful for it, and they become wiser still, and what happens is that they show that they have a tender heart because they want to know God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, And what does verse 10 go on to say? And the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. But to know God is to know yourself. Calvin would say this in the Institutes of the Christian Religion. John Calvin would argue that we need to know God and we need to know ourselves. The more we know God, the more we know ourselves. And the more we know ourselves, the more we know God. And that makes us wise unto salvation. And as a result of that, this child then can be launched into the world with all sorts of preparations, because now the parents are going to disappear at the end of chapter 9, and the child is going to go out and learn to live in the world. And as they learn to live in the world, what they're going to find is that it's not so black and white as mom and dad painted it out to be. But mom and dad painted a contrast of black and white, because what you need to start off in life is, when you've got young kids, this is what you do. There is good and there is bad. But then you have to nuance those things as they age and as they grow. You have to give them moral reasoning, moral instruction. You have to show that life is complicated because of motives. There's complications because of all sorts of factors that you have to take in, that you have to consider. And when you take in all those factors, you're prepared to be launched out into the world like this son is at the end of chapter 9, because then you know the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and it is the insight of the Holy One that gives you knowledge. And all of this is intended so that we would see the wisdom of Christ. I want us to see the wisdom of Christ and how Christ does this. Peter began our service this morning by reading from the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus speaks about the wise man and the foolish man. And the wise man and the foolish man are both people who are, they look very similar. They build a house. And they build a house just like woman wisdom does here at the opening of our chapter. The woman wisdom at chapter 9 of Proverbs, she builds a house. But here's the difference in what happens. Is that one builds his house on rock and one builds his house on sand. And here is what we need to understand. The good life cannot avoid the storms of life, but it learns to weather them. The good life cannot avoid the storms of life, but it can weather them. And this is the principle that Jesus is making from Proverbs in his closing on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27. When hardship comes, it is no indication that God does not love you. When difficulties come, it is no indication that God hates you. How do I know that? Because just as there's sun, there's rain. Just as the spring will come, winter will also come, and there will be snowstorms, and there will be blizzards. And just as there are going to be calm days, there are going to be windy days. And if that's what nature is like, then that's what life is like too. And if life is like that, then we ought to understand that God is calling us to live in a world where Adam's sin and fall and corruption has affected everything. And therefore, you need to be prepared that storms are going to come. Jesus said, in this world, you will have lots of ease and peace and comfort and great times. No, he said, in this world you will have trouble. But take heart. Why? For I have overcome the world. You see, Jesus is the one who in the darkest hour, when darkness covered the land, when he was pierced by nails, a crown of thorns showing the curse of thorns from Genesis 3 was placed on his head when darkness covered the land, when he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? When the greatest storm of life came to Jesus, and when he faced death, he did not stay dead, but he was raised again to life by his very own Father, raised in the resurrection power, raised to newness of life, raised so that we would know that he can taste death, and that he can bring us to life. So how many John Lennon songs did we sing this morning? How many John Lennon songs did you sing this week? How many of you don't even know who John Lennon is? Just be honest and put up your hand. Is there anybody here who doesn't know who John Lennon? Thank you. John Lennon will be forgotten. John Lennon's songs won't be sung. But something more enduring and lasting exists. And we sing to him and we praise him. So why build your life on something that is momentary? Why build your life on something that won't last? On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. And so, Father, I pray that what you would help us to discern and to decide is to live a life that is built upon something that will last not just for a decade, not just for 50 years or 80 years, but something that will last for eternity. Help us to build our lives on you, because you are the solid rock. You are the one who endures. You are the one whose songs we will sing throughout the ages. That we can imagine all the people living on the earth in peace and harmony, just as John Lennon sang, but not because there is no heaven or hell, but because you are a God who has endured the storm of darkness to bring us out of darkness into your marvelous light and keep us there forever. So root us, Lord, in the wisdom that existed at the beginning of creation, the wisdom that formed the world, the wisdom that will endure long past the end of this world. And when the new creation comes, the wisdom will still endure. Root us in that wisdom, Lord, that we might live the good life. And as we journey into Proverbs 10 through 29, would you help us then to launch out into the world with the wisdom that you have given to us by our forefathers? We need your wisdom, Lord. So we lack it. We ask for it. Please give it. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.